as you showed us passing through Singapore again today. On my way from New York to Perth. So as I've been here, I always like to break up the long journey by staying overnight. But for a month, there's no such thing as a free lunch. So it's wonderful being able to give a nice talk this evening. And also, it is June the 16th was Ajahn Chah's official birthday. And this is just past the last 6 days ago. He would be 99 if he was still alive today. So next year will probably be even more special, the 100th anniversary. And again, so much is said about Ajahn Chah, and I do have a different angle on that great monk. It wasn't his Vinaya or his asceticism which really inspired me. It was his kindness and his incredible wisdom which blew my mind away. Now, first of all, the reason I ended up in that temple, I had no intention of staying so long in Thailand, or even staying so long as a monk. But there was something which I did hear about the Thai Buddhist tradition, which I thought was quite helpful, which was that you didn't need to be a monk forever. I still remember one gentleman who was very inspired. He wanted to become a monk, but he said, "Can I have every Saturday evening off?" I can't really do that. But, so I decided to take a year or two off my life roughly about 1973. I decided I wanted to become monk. Getting to the right tradition, the right place, again, in many traditions, disrobal is looked upon as being shameful, like you failed. But there's such a positive attitude from that tradition which I eventually joined, that even if you're only a monk for a few days or a few weeks, the fact you've done that is amazing. You never criticize a person for their failures, but you always praise a person for what they've achieved, what they've done. I found that very refreshing. So, I started going to the local Buddhist temple in London, where I grew up. And when you were telling me about giving them the keys to open up this place at 7 a.m. in the morning, I remembered that while I was waiting to actually get confirmation I could go to Thailand to become a monk, I would get on my motorbike every morning. I had a motorbike. Long hair, you can imagine me, my little vroom, vroom, vroom. get on the motorbike and go to the Thai temple at 6 o'clock in the morning. They were supposed to have their chanting. And many mornings I'd be banging on the door to wake up the monks so I could do the chanting. They were very glad, they were so happy when I went off to Thailand. Now they could sleep in. So but anyway, when I was visiting that temple, I remember talking with many visitors how I wanted to become a monk and asking for some advice, where should I go? And there's one gentleman in particular, I was told he had just been to Thailand for a year or so and had been a monk, disrobed, and came back to London. And I asked him, and I found later on that he was a monk with Ajahn Chah, but he never told me. When I saw him many years later, why didn't he tell me about this great master? I had to find him myself. And he said, "You were smiling so much even then, I didn't think you were serious about being a monk." So just because you are smiling and happy doesn't mean you're not interested in following that Dharma even further. So I had to find my own way to see Ajahn Chah. So I said to all my family and friends at the time, "I'll just be a monk for 1 or 2 years. I had a good degree, good prospects in life, a proper young man. And so I could decide to put my usual career on hold for a year or two. Like in Singapore, you do national service. This was my religious service for 2 years. And it was wonderful, that sense of freedom there. You could go and become a monk for however long you wanted, and if you did need to disrobe, you were allowed to. And to this day, I often think, and I feel a lot of compassion and sympathy for monks and nuns of other parts of Buddhism and also other religions, in particular Catholic priests and Catholic nuns, who they ordain into that tradition out of so much inspiration and faith when they're young. And later on in their life, they realize it was a wrong decision. And sometimes they can't change. They're stuck. They're stuck in a vow which they made when they were young, which means they're not at peace and happy with it. So I was always very, 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 very pleased with the idea that people do change, and your vows of celibacy in particular, if you feel that no, it's not the right thing to do, then leave with all of the honour and respect and gratitude you've done so much in such a time. And to this day, this is totally off topic. When any one of my monks disrobes, they do it and they're respected for that. They get an empty medal and try it. As soon as they do disrobe, there's a lot of very well-informed and intelligent young women who are looking for a good partner in life. They come and swarm around the newly disrobed monks because they keep telling me this. They say, people who've been trained by Ajahn Brahm for a couple of years make excellent husbands. I train them, and you marry them. And it's true, honestly. But I don't, not everyone will stay as a monk, and I'm very happy that they always keep supporting our temple coming back, and so I'm very happy that you can actually support people in so many different ways. So, again, I found my way to Thailand, and people have told me about this great monk over in the northeast of Thailand, and I was led to have a look to see if he was the real thing. And my first experience with Ajahn Chah was that he was a fake. We've got to be honest, because first impressions often are unreliable. So because what we were doing, his mother had just died, I should be able to say that I think it was in 1974 that his mother died, and we were doing a cremation in the grounds for her. If a person does become a monk or a nun, you don't abandon your family. It's not as if you haven't got a son or a daughter anymore. But you know, you've got a really top quality son, a top quality daughter, who can look after you much better than if they were in the labour. Honestly, that's the case. So, and we were making some baskets for some monument to his mother. I couldn't understand what we were doing it for. And I remember as I was making the basket, Ajahn Chah came past and said, "Oh, what a wonderful job you're doing." I looked at my basket, I looked at other people's baskets, and I say, "No, that's not the case. I'm not going to be flattered into staying with you." So that's how I thought of the fellow that did know Western psychology. You can see through that flattery very, very quickly. But then what turned me to respecting this monk enormously was when I was doing my basket work, and there was another monk who was a novice monk who decided he wanted to ask some questions on the Dhamma from this monk. And I was in earshot of this conversation. And some of you may have had this experience before yourselves. It's weird and it's strange that this monk from Los Angeles would ask a question, be translated to Ajahn Chah. Ajahn Chah would give the answer and translate it back. And the answer had nothing at all to do with the question. It was totally off topic. And then this young novice would ask another question, Ajahn Chah would give another answer, had no relationship at all to the question asked. But it was all the questions I was thinking in my mind. And this was weird. And I asked another question in my mind. I thought the question, just to check out if this was real. I was a scientist, theoretical physicist. And there I thought of a question, and then this novice had a totally different question. So the answer came back, and that was my question. That was spooky. So there was personal proof, to me anyway, that this monk could read my mind. Not just know the question, but give really excellent answers. And to confirm it, I don't ask that novice afterwards, what did you think about those answers from Ajahn Chah? He said, it was crazy, it made no sense at all to me. Nothing at all to do with the questions I asked. I said, yes. And when you find a wise person like that, you know, he does work on a much deeper level, then that was really interesting to have a teacher like that. And of course, later on, you find that it's not just his understanding of the teachings which was impressive. It was just that how he related, you know, to all the difficulties, you know, which people had in their lives. It was like, you know, what we call these days emotional intelligence. I've noticed many, many people who are very, very well educated, you know, who know Pali, know the traditions, and can recite exactly where that particular saying comes from. But in real life, that they don't know how to use that wisdom to have peace and happiness in their real life. And this was what was impressive with my own experience of Ajahn Chah, how his answers could be just so easy to understand. You did not need to be a Pali scholar. In fact, what he said was far deeper than what I knew of the Abhidhamma. It was really, really powerful. For example, the story when I was there and a professor came from Sweden. And this professor announced that he was being sponsored by the Swedish government because even in that time, which must have been about 76, 77, that the Swedish government realized just that meditation was very important. And many people were going over to Asia to learn meditation, and they wanted to find out exactly what meditation was and its benefits. So this professor was sponsored by the Swedish government to research on what meditation is. Now if you've ever done any research, to standardize that research, you have the same set of questions which you will ask every person in your sample. And this particular case was well-known meditation teachers. Not just Theravada, Mahayana, Vajrayana, not just Buddhists, but even the Hindu tradition as well. So they'd already been through India to the most respected and well-known gurus which he could find, and also to Nepal, to ask any Rinpoches or meditation teachers which he could find. And now he was working his way through Southeast Asia, and he had heard of Ajahn Chah, so he came, had an audience with Ajahn Chah to ask the same four questions which he asked so many other masters throughout the world. And those four questions he asked were, what is meditation? Why do you meditate? How do you meditate? And what do you get out of meditation? What's the result? Now, it was very inspiring as well as entertaining to be around a monk like Ajahn Chah. These days we call it infotainment. But that jokes, I was there a long time before that word arose. So listening to him was not only, you know, entertaining, but it also was just so profound. How he could use humour, again, for us to go very deep into the truth of things. So, straight away, when those questions were translated to Ajahn Chah, I remember him scratching his head, which he never did, and asking for a piece of paper and a pencil, which again he never did. So when he starts to act a little bit out of the usual, you know this is going to be fun. What is this great like up to now? So, he again got a piece of paper, scratched his head again, and wrote down the four answers to the four questions. Now, what is meditation? Why meditate? How to meditate? And what you get out of meditation? And when the answers were translated, I just burst out laughing like everyone else did, except the professor did not laugh. What was the answer to the first question? What is meditation? This was Ajahn Chah's answer. What is eating? Second question. Why do you meditate? Why do you eat? Third question. How do you meditate? How do you eat? And the fourth question. What do you get out of meditation? What do you get out of eating? Straight away the professor got very upset and said, I cannot take that to my government. And Ajahn Chah replied, that's all you're getting. So for us it was very funny, but it was also very meaningful. So how many times have you gone to lectures on how to meditate? And all sorts of meditation instructions, all the different methods of meditating. Come on, have you ever gone to a seminar on how to eat? I mean, actually, it would be very popular in Singapore. an eating seminar for the day. Of course, you'd have to be, you know, interactive and just experiential to look at the finding foods here. But no, why do we make it so difficult? With all the theories and instructions on what really should be something so simple. Did anyone ever tell you how to eat? It's something which comes natural to you when you stop thinking about it. Just like meditation as well. So that's how to meditate, how to eat. Now, what is meditation? What is eating? Has anyone done a PhD on eating? Or what it actually is? Have you got any positions in NUS about professor of eating? Eating is gorgeous, yes. Put aside the negative stuff. Why? And why do you eat? It's very profound. You eat for good health. Not for its own sake, so that you can do your services and jobs in the world. And if anyone just looks at my tummy, this happened again when I was in the United States. The people said, oh please, eat some of this, it's very nice. I made it for you specially. I've got no choice. You know, my compassion. It is absolutely true. People are so kind. And they give me something, they make sure I eat it. You know, what can I do? They put it in the tummy because my tummy does not belong to me. I sacrifice it long ago. It's your tummy to make good karma out of. And that's honest. So why do we eat? Who am I? It's actually to allow people to make good karma with you. Make merit with you. That's one of the purposes. And that's not just an excuse. That's actually the truth. So we find out why we eat. And sometimes, look, we always get the question on vegetarianism. I recall as a student, I was a very strict vegetarian. Even just when you show a shop which sold meat, I would now cross to the other side of the street because I couldn't bear to go past it. I was that extreme. And I went to a girlfriend's house for dinner one evening. She went up inviting me for dinner. And I really thought she should have known I was a vegetarian. And she cooked her meal with meat in it. And I refused to eat that meal. That was the end of that relationship. To this day, I look back upon that and felt just, what a nasty thing that was for me to do. And to refuse this really good woman who really wanted to actually to do something nice for me. And to, she put so much effort into making a meal for me, and I just refused to even touch it. So I was kind to animals, but really cruel to human beings. So I always remember that, just know the kindness and the purpose of these things, the purpose of meditating, what we're doing that for. And so in a very simple way, my master Ajahn Chah taught me something which was anyone could understand. And I also started to realize, well, I would get upset at things. This monk would never get upset. He was so wise. And I asked him about his education. And this monk had only been 4 years of school, just grade 4, and he had to leave. And I had got these great degrees from one of the best universities. And how stupid I felt. He was far wiser. And with simple things. And that was really impressive. He wasn't strict. He was kind. He wasn't ascetic. He was always at ease with himself and with everything else. You never see him grimacing or getting angry. But this is one of those stories, which I don't know if you have heard of. It was reminded, I remember was reminded of this when people said, oh, Ajahn Chah was so ascetic. He wasn't that ascetic. He was very kind and very simple. That's why I like to be around him. But this was a time when one of the monks, you know, who I grew up with, he decided to do as many of these austere practices as possible. Because what he did was not sleeping at night, sitting up, not laying down, only eating what he got on alms round, I forget all the other traditions he was trying to keep. And Ajahn Chah was visiting the monastery where he was practicing, and this monk, a Canadian monk, he had an epileptic fit in front of Ajahn Chah. The only time in his life he's had an epileptic fit. He fell off the raised platform where the monks usually sat and cracked his head open. Lots of blood. Ajahn Chah saw that and said, you Westerners just do not understand the ascetic practices. You're just so highly motivated that you are going to be more ascetic than the monk sitting next to you. It's just keeping up with the Joneses. And said, that is not what those things are there for. And I always remember that experience. So when people say, oh, Ajahn Chah was so ascetic, I say, no, that's not the case. So anyway, he learned so much from him on many different levels. One of the other things was just how he could put aside, you know, what, you know, was supposed to be even the teachings and the Vinaya, and be totally intuitive, unpredictable, and do things which I've never ever seen anyone do before or again. One of those examples which I recall just was his understanding of psychology, which was far deeper than I've ever seen in any conference, coming from practical psychologists. And we're all taught what to do within psychology. This is the syndrome, this is what you should do. But he would never keep to those rules. So this particular case, there was somebody who was possessed by some demon, some spirit. Now in Singapore, you know, you're so frightened of spirits. But this was a real spirit going inside somebody's body. And it happened the night before, and the local villagers, they couldn't do anything, so they usually take them to the nearest holy monk, anyway. And so Ajahn Chah, I was there, they were saying, you know, in his hut, they were saying, the villagers came early in the morning, this woman has been possessed. We can't do anything about it, so we're bringing her to see you. And where Ajahn Chah's hut was maybe, maybe about 700, 800 meters from the front gate at that time. And you could hear her screaming that far away. She was really mad. And they had two or three, you know, villagers, farmers, who were really big and strong, struggling to bring her to see Ajahn Chah. If any of you have seen somebody who was so psychotic, they got enormous, almost supernatural strength. And so, as soon as Ajahn Chah heard what had happened, and knew that he had to deal with this, what was Ajahn Chah's response? He shouted at one of the novices, "Dig a hole! A big hole, a deep hole. We need it dug now." And another novice, "Pour some water." In those days you had to get some wood out, put the kettle on top of the wood on the little stove. I need lots of hot water, lots and lots and lots of boiling water. And if you're in the presence of a great monk, you will know, what the heck is he doing? What's hot water in a hole got to do with someone in a psychosis? Or someone who is possessed? But it's really interesting because, oh, this is interesting to see. I know what's going to happen next. So when they actually brought this woman, arriving, literally foaming at the mouth, with big eyes, I couldn't understand Thai that well then, but she was swearing profanities. But if you know Thai culture, you don't swear profanities like that in any temple, let alone in front of her, like a well-known holy monk like Ajahn Chah. Some of the language which she was using was really, really gross. But she was possessed. So the villagers dragged her in to see Ajahn Chah. And when they dragged her in there, Ajahn Chah, "It's a hole finished yet, we need a deep hole. We need more boiling water, more boiling water." At the same time, the villagers were struggling to hold down this crazy woman. "Is it ready yet? Is it ready yet?" And it was like exciting for a young monk. You know, we don't get much excitement as a monk. We don't watch a TV or just listen to music, so it's a very boring life. But when you see this in real life, this is fascinating. And then she was writhing and just all over the place. And I heard this later on. Monks should be very careful dealing with such things. Because one of the monks in the north of Thailand, this is many years later, he was getting very well known doing exorcisms, and they brought one of these women who was supposed to be possessed, and he was doing some exorcism, sprinkling holy water and doing some chanting. The very, very strength, a lot of strength when you're in such a psychosis. And quick as lightning, this woman put her hand under his robe and grabbed his testicles and would not let go. But any man here would just go, "Ooh." It tells you the answer, what monks wear under their robes. No protection. And she would not let go. And that was the last time this monk ever performed an exorcism. He was so frightened afterwards, he couldn't walk properly for months. But Ajahn Chah was much wiser than that monk. So, and he's, you know, I asked him, what do you need a hole for? What are you doing this for? And Ajahn Chah gave the answer, it's the demon, the monster, the spirit in this woman's body. It's a really, really dangerous one. Really dangerous. The only way we can deal with this is to throw this woman with the spirit into the hole, pour boiling water all over her, and then bury her. That's the only way. Yes, it must be done that way. Now, if you were living with an Ajahn Chah, even though that seems so gross and so cruel, you know, you think, no one could do that. If you were with Ajahn Chah, I said, he could. He was so unconventional that even I thought he could do that, and he might do that. But even more so, all the villagers, and especially that woman who was possessed, also knew that Ajahn Chah was capable of that. So, deep psychology, self-preservation, is one of the deepest of forces in the human mind. And she knew if she did not get her act together quickly, she would be thrown in that hole with boiling water poured all over her and then buried. And if you believe that's going to happen to you, you calm down pretty quickly. And it's amazing to see just how effective that worked. And it took 2 or 3 minutes, and this woman, exhausted, was now sitting in front of Ajahn Chah, so calm. She's out of exhaustion, but all the threshing around, all of the swearing had all gone. And Ajahn Chah just quickly gave her the 5 Buddhist precepts and said, take her away to have a nice rest. And that was like the wisdom for Ajahn Chah. That was just mind-blowing psychology. You know, I've never seen anything like that before. And that would be totally banned in the Singapore College of Psychiatrists. You can't do that. But it worked, because he was totally unconventional. You can't read that in any sutta. I was taking those sutras and that practice so much deeper. Just that self-preservation which is in every human being. Tapping into that, leveraging it, so that it would cure her psychosis. Whether it was a spirit or whether it was a psychosis, I will never know. But I do know if it worked. So that was Ajahn Chah's great teaching. But there's so many other times that what I remember of his teachings was just so simple stuff. And understanding that's why many villagers loved him as well as their professors. To go right to the heart of the matter in something so easy. Can I borrow your card there? Okay. This is just something. I won't doubt you too much. That about attachments and letting go. Because many times in psychology and Buddhism, we say if you want to have a happy life, a peaceful life, you have to let go of all the pain of the past. Now, sometimes your loved one dies. Sometimes, you know, you're abused as a child. Sometimes in a relationship, you keep recording all the bad things which happened. And he said, that is not a wise Buddhist way of dealing with things. Please let go. Let go especially of the stuff which you should not be holding on to, which is causing you suffering and pain. You've all heard monks like me say that, all traditions, let go of the past, don't worry about the future, live in the present moment. And if you've got a name like Eckhart Tolle, you can make a fortune on that teaching. But this is a common teaching which has been here for years in all traditions. But how do you teach people to do that? Even myself, that people keep asking, yeah, I know I should let go, but how do I do it? How do I let go? And so this great master, not messing around, he'd pick up a stick from the forest, this is my stick, and he said, how heavy is this? It's only heavy as long as you're holding it. That's not got any weight at all. So it's easy to let go. Just throw it away. It's only heavy when you're holding it. Grief, anger, feeling people have cheated you, it's only heavy when you hold it. You can't throw it away. So in order to help people do that, Lesser Ajahn Chah, and he gave the essence of it, it's so simple to do, to be able to throw things away. I started off by asking people to write down all the things you're upset of, with your husband, with your wife, with your job, with Donald Trump. How many people have heard this? Did you hear about the assassination attempt on Donald Trump? You haven't heard that? No, this, in one of his talks, his rallies, this guy came up and pulled out a gun and pointed it at the president. And one of the security there shouted out, "Donald Duck!" At which point the assassin started laughing and couldn't pull the trigger. That's only a joke, not a true story. You won't find that on the news this evening. Anyhow, so instead what I ask people to do is to put all of that stuff which are hurting you, which is stopping your happiness, and the grief, the ill will, don't try and justify it. Just write it all down on a piece of paper and actually tie that piece of paper onto a stick and just throw it into the forest. Like Ajahn Chah, it's only heavy when you hold it. And when you throw it away, you let it go. You renounce, you let go. All those words in the Dhamma which you've heard many times. Do something physical. Even that, you know, I tried encouraging people to do that in my retreat center, but what happened? You had all these pieces of paper lying around in the forest. Environmentally damaging. So what I did, it's all come from Ajahn Chah, I'm just elaborating on it, which Ajahn Chah would always do. You don't stick with the method you've got, no, just take it one step further. So yes, you have to write it down. And I was giving a conference on the Australian Association of Buddhists, Counselors and Psychotherapists. If you find most counselors and psychotherapists are Buddhists, so that's something you can leverage, you know, with Buddhism, psychotherapy and psychology is huge. So anyway, so I said, yeah, write it down on a piece of paper, first of all, because that serves the purpose of acknowledging it, bringing it up to the surface so it really is, you know, clear to you what happened. And be honest, the bad stuff, which other people have done, and also your bad stuff as well. But because paper is very expensive, I devised a method of using a toilet roll. Because toilet paper is incredibly cheap. And you can write so much on a toilet paper. But I also said, please use a brown felt tip pen. The colour is important. Because when you see, after you've written down all the stuff you're holding on to, which you refuse to let go of, when you see it all in brown colour on a piece of toilet paper, in psychology we call that association. You make the obvious link with the other stuff which is brown, which goes on toilet paper. And you also understand that not even the president of the World Wildlife Foundation, Greenpeace, environmental agencies, even they only use one side of the toilet paper. When you've got a little bit of brown on the toilet paper, Do you fold it up, put it in your pocket so you can use it again? No one ever does that, even a toilet. You wasteful, destroy the environment, the planet. You should use your toilet paper more efficiently. Only when it's brown on all corners and in the middle on both sides, then fair enough, it's right away. No one ever does that. So, as soon as a tiny bit of brown on the toilet paper, you have to throw it away. So what that does is giving you the association, the importance of throwing it away, of letting it go. Just like Ajahn Chah, you hold it, it's heavy, throw it away, no waste at all. So of course, you don't throw the toilet paper in the forest, you go to the special temple where people spend a lot of their time in life. In fact, you spend more time in the toilet cubicle than you ever do in the temple. It's true. So I want to make use of that. So you put it in the toilet bowl and you do the letting go ceremony. The little button at the top. You let it go. That is advancing Ajahn Chah's teaching. Please, you can take it further if you can possibly find a way. So those are the practical ways which I learned from a monk, Sikh, and Ajahn Chah. He was inspiring, but also, he was unconventional. That's one of the things which you try and bring to the Dhamma in our modern world. Now, if you're nice to have a Sutta studies, but you can read them for yourself. Meditation instructions, talk Anapanasati, you can read that for yourself. Eightfold Path, I don't know how many people took the Eightfold Path. So much so that there was in a Sri Lankan temple, this apparently happened, that somebody was with a monk, a venerable, was reciting the Eightfold Path teaching. So the Eightfold Path, he began, is Samma Ditti, Samma Sankhya, Samma Vaccha, Samma Nirvana. What's the next one? And then somebody shouted out, Samma Sleeping. And it's true. Sometimes these talks are so boring, you know what's going to happen, and so no one pays attention at all. What a waste of time that is, for the teacher and also for the audience. So, he was innovative, and it was always unexpected, and very profound as well. Because some of the stuff he said was, you look back, and it's absolutely true. But at the time, he didn't understand it. He thought it was a crazy monk. But when people talk about his deeper teachings, not just about how to live a beautiful, peaceful life, but some of his deeper teachings were given to me the very first year I was there. This is one of the deepest teachings I got from Ajahn Chah, living with him. Couldn't understand a word of it. It made total nonsense to me, but later on I realized how essential this was, to the deep part of meditation and also enlightenment itself. That's why I never understood that. I wasn't ready for it. But he taught me that even teachings which you don't understand, you still remember. You can't forget them. They go in there somewhere in your consciousness, waiting like seeds, waiting for a time when they're ready to germinate. And that particular teaching was the mango orchard teaching, where he told me that his monastery in the northeast of Thailand was like a mango orchard, and those mangoes were planted by the Buddha, and each one of those mango trees has hundreds, thousands of delicious mangoes all ready to be eaten. He said, the problem is, you cannot climb that tree to reach the mango. If you throw a stick up, you'll always miss. Even if you shake the tree, it will never fall. No mangoes can be got that way. He said there's only one way to get the mangoes from the tree planted by the Buddha, and that is to sit perfectly still underneath the tree, open out your hand, and a mango will fall. And that was the end of the simile. And I thought, how dumb can you be? You can wait for years sitting under a tree. Here, sit underneath a mango tree and just wait for it to fall. Hours and hours and hours and hours, days and days. And if it does fall, where's it going to fall? On top of your head. So then that made no sense. But later on, in my own practice and in your practice too, how many times you try and shake yourself, shake the Dhamma, try to get somewhere in your meditation, try to get wisdom and enlightenment. Put forth effort, struggle, strive. So that's like shaking the tree, throwing sticks up at it, nothing falls. Made no sense to me at the time. Until after a while, you do. Mostly out of frustration, nothing's working, so you give up, so you might as well just sit down there and do nothing. And that's when things happen. Sitting under the mango tree. I was wondering, what did it mean by opening your hand? It meant opening your heart. Some kindness, compassion, so forth. And then it fell. How wonderful that was to experience. And how a great master like Ajahn Chah taught with such wisdom and compassion. It's so hard for people to stop striving. You can. You sit perfectly still with an open heart. And every Dhamma in the world just falls into you. Chase it, try and climb the tree, nothing happens. And that was amazing teaching on letting go. But he was also, again, great fun as well. All the rites and rituals we have in Buddhism. We have so many rituals, the lighting the insects, in the insects, the incense and other stuff. And this particular one was holy water, blessing water. Now, I love holy water and blessings because sometimes Ajahn Chah never did that. Yes, he did. I saw him. And what he used to do, use whatever was around. So this one particular case which I saw, and this was Ajahn Chah really, I thought, going too far. You know, sometimes that when you are wise, and when you are funny, sometimes you can just go a little bit too far. I actually told that Donald Trump joke in New York, and I said, doesn't matter, I'm leaving the country tomorrow. So I can escape. So this was, I think you all know that the political system in Thailand, the military had enormous power. The current government is a military government. And this was a time when the generals, I'm not sure if they were in power at the time, but they were serving very powerful people. You do not mess around with a major general. Except if you're Ajahn Chah. So this big general came with all his lieutenants, he'd never come alone, to speak with this great master and ask for a blessing. Great wisdom of Ajahn Chah. He wanted some holy water. There wasn't any water next to Ajahn Chah, so he said, come here, come here. And so this great powerful general with his troops around him, he bent down and said, bend down your head. And then Ajahn Chah spat all over his head. Now, even like touching a head, you know, that's a no-no in Thai culture. And not only that, then he got his hand and rubbed it. All over, oh, you've gone too far now. You can do that with a Westerner or someone or a professor, but not with a general. And I thought that was it, that was the end of Ajahn Chah. He could be taken away, arrested, and disappeared. That's amazing. Just afterwards, That general, he just stood up, he's beaming all over his face. Wow, thank you, thank you. A special blessing straight from the source. And that was a child with his rites and rituals to reduce it. It was so funny. The general believed it. He went away. He's so happy. Just like that time when I was meditating all night in the jungles. And after meditating all night, you know, he had to go to the toilet. So, yeah, there was sort of toilets. And this was jungles. Just, you know, the old tradition, you squat down and you know, the squatting position, which you learn, should be really healthy for you. There's some squat toilets still have. I like those squat toilets. They're really nice. You squat down in a jungle and then you urinate. Now, there's two things to know about this. It was early dawn, so it wasn't very light. Number two, been meditating all night, so I was tired. So my faculties weren't that sharp, and the light wasn't that sharp either. So when I squatted down and urinated in the forest, I really thought I was urinating on a stick. Until that stick started to move. It was a snake, a very dangerous snake. Now you can imagine, you know, standing up a male, urinating, you've got some distance. But when you're squatting down, the most sensitive part of a man's body is only a couple of inches away from that snake's mouth. That was dangerous. But that snake never bit me, never even moved. And I thought, wow, is it the power of my meditation? I said, no. There was a snake who had been parents, genetic type snake, and it obviously thought it was being blessed with a holy water for a great buck. Just like Ajahn Chah's spit, this would be even more powerful. True story. You know, anything about the snake? I thought the snake must have thought it was holy water. Pretty good. So, I told you not to be afraid. But there are problems in life. And these are those deep teachings which, oh, good old Ajahn Chah, so simple, but so profound, practical, which you'll never forget. You know, just like when we had all these mosquitoes around. There were lots and lots of mosquitoes in those days. There wasn't dengue fever, there's malaria fever, and many other sort of really nasty things you could catch. But whenever we complained about the mosquitoes, we couldn't get any mosquito repellent. We couldn't get any mosquito netting or coils. That stuff wasn't really available in the poor part of Northeast Korea. So when we complained about the danger, we said, no. From now on, you have to regard those irritants as your teacher. He told us to regard them as Ajahn, mosquito. So instead of being negative about them, complaining, respect them and learn from them. And that's when I understood one of his greatest teachings. You learn from what troubles you. You don't try and get rid of it. So if you're having a difficult relationship with your partner, it's Ajahn husband. You learn a lot when he gives you a hard time. And it's amazing just how well that worked. Now, from learning that mosquitoes aren't the problem, it's you worrying about them is the problem. I never realized this, how scientific that turned out to be, until keeping up with my science, read an article about why mosquitoes bite you. They are drawn by the carbon dioxide which comes out of your pores. The more carbon dioxide which comes out, the more they can find you. The higher your metabolism, the more you're saying, mosquitoes come here. the more you're worried and afraid. The higher metabolism, the more you're visible to those mosquitoes. But you just relax, not worry, let go. That's almost nature's mosquito repellent, become invisible. That explains a lot why, when I was being bitten by mosquitoes and worried about them, they'd bite me more. When I just let go and relax, especially going into deep meditations, afterwards you look at your arm, there's no mosquito bites there. I always wondered why that was. It's just because when you're in deep meditation, you do get so calm and peaceful, your metabolism goes way down. Very excellent teaching, similar to the teaching when the locals in the village were having a big party. When they're having a big party, they wouldn't party that often, but when they did, it went on for days. And they only finished when they were totally exhausted, usually about 2 a.m. And they start the next day. But 2 a.m. was when they stopped. 3 o'clock in the morning was when the bell went, when we had to go and do our chanting and meditation. We're only getting 1 hour's sleep. It wasn't enough. So we went to complain. No, first of all, we complained to the local headman. Okay, to have a party, but you know, just can you stop at midnight or 1 o'clock, please? Get a couple of hours of sleep at night, please. And of course, they would never worry about us. But when we decided to go see Ajahn Chah, they were terrified of Ajahn Chah. He could, you know, throw them in a pit and pour boiling water on them. So we decided to go to see Ajahn Chah. You would be able to tell those headmen of the village to stop for the recent time. If you said it, they would follow. So what happened? He said, no. It's not the sound disturbs you. It's you who disturb the sound. That's all. And I practice that even to today. Good old Arthur over there, he's let me stay in his hut overnight, in his house, overnight flight from JFK, tired, jet lagged. So I was staying in his father's house this morning. Very beautiful house, very comfortable, except for your dog. So what did I do? I didn't go down the stairs and kill your darling dog. That's not a Buddhist way of doing things. So instead, I remembered my great Ajahn Chah's teaching. It's not the dog disturbs you, it's you who disturb the dog. And I had a nice sleep after that. And that is so important in life. Because sometimes we complain about things. It's not the noise or the pain in your body disturbs you. It's you who disturb that pain. Simple one-liner like that changed the whole way of looking at life. And it works, which is amazing stuff. You practice that and you find it's what you add. The disturbances of life are much more powerful than disturbances. The dog barking over there. Thanks for bringing Scrubby today. The name of that dog. So, it works in most of our life. You don't expect people to be any different. It's not your husband disturbs you. It's you who disturb your husband. Husbands are like that. It's not your wife disturbs you. Wives are like that. I'm a monk. I haven't got a wife. I haven't got a husband. But I know. So don't disturb life. And then life doesn't disturb you. Powerful. Great teaching about himself, which I couldn't really understand. And even the time when I was really sick over in hospital, my last summer after this last anecdote,
This is my life without Him, child. It's dumber in ways I could understand so deeply. I didn't like hearing these dumbers. I liked them more intellectual. But whenever we'd ask an intellectual question, he said, "You Westerners, you're so highly educated, you're like vultures." He compared us to vultures. We fly so high in the sky, but our food is just the dead rotting corpses on the ground. And I thought, wow, you guys, you understood this. So when I was really sick in hospital, with typhus fever, almost dying, at least I thought I was dying, and he felt so depressed over there in Thailand. I always remember this nurse, I'll never forget her. Now, there was a nurse in this monk's ward in Ubon Hospital, 1975, I think. Now, I was in hospital today, doing some chanting for somebody, and all the nurses over in Singapore, all young, petite, pretty, not the nurses which were in Northeast Thailand, I understand. This nurse was more like a Russian weightlifter on steroids. She was so big. She reminded me, honestly, of a water buffalo. And she had to be like that because, like myself, you had to get an injection of antibiotics. I had a big fever, no one knew what it was, so I had to be injected with a cocktail of antibiotics. Now, this was many years ago. In the days, some of you may remember the recycled needles. They would actually have to keep sterilizing them, using them over and over and over again. You're so lucky these days. Really high-tech needles, super sharp, one use only. Oh, not what I was young. When I was young, they had to keep sterilizing them, and I'm not sure if this was true, but I was told it's quite possible. They would use them in Bangkok, first of all. And then, you know, when they would dare use them in Bangkok, they'd send them up to the provinces, you know, to save costs. You know, even these days, health budget, very, very difficult. You know, it's always a strain on the economy, just how much money is spent on health. And even this happened in Perth recently. This guy woke up after a very simple keyhole operation. He had some problem in his stomach. He woke up with a splitting headache. And he asked the nurse, "Can I take some painkiller? I've got a splitting migraine." And the nurse said, "You can't have it. You never touched your head. It was just a keyhole in your intestines or something." He said, "But my head hurts." And she felt it. And essentially, it was red, inflamed. You could feel the heat. There was a bit of a bump there. She said, "Well, this must be something gone wrong with the operation." So she rang up the surgeon. "This is a complication. Something's happened. My patient, you know, he's got a big migraine and a swelling on his head." And I said, "Oh, that's to be expected. And because of cutting costs, we ran out of anaesthetic, so we had to use the hammer." It's going to happen one day. Cutting costs. But anyway, for me, but honestly, this nurse would not inject you. You know, like normally they push it through and they bang, stab you. That's no exaggeration. Twice a day, morning and afternoon, stab in the buttocks. It reminded me of like going to the principal's office. And I do have lots of compassion and kindness. But not to her. So much. You're already sick enough with a fever and having a really sore bum afterwards as well. But anyway, Ajahn Chah came to visit. I was such a young monk, and he came to visit me. And I, "Oh, thank you, thank you." He's really got compassion as well as his wisdom. And just, I felt so good. You know, when somebody you never expect just comes by and goes through all the trouble to visit you. And then he leant over and he said these words which I will never forget. And what he said was, "Mama wants her. You're either going to get better or you're going to die." And then he left. That was absolutely true. Nothing more than that. And the worst thing is you can't argue with that. That's so true. So the dam was great, it's bedside manner, you know, it's not all that. I'd always look kind with compassion, hang out with my teacher, I don't know that. He just hit me over the head with his dam, it's so powerful. So those are some of the teachings and experiences you remember with a great teacher. If you want to know about the Four Noble Truths, you can read it in the book, Eightfold Path. But this is how that translated into real life. Impermanence? You could either get better or you die. What's the problem? You can't argue with that. You're not going to be sick forever. So, yeah. You're going to get out of hospital one way or the other. Either two legs or in a box. But you're not going to stay with that one. So, just such brilliant teachings, which I'm so grateful to have learned. Now, of course, when people say, oh, that's not what Ajahn Chah taught, this is what he taught. At his funeral service, which I attended in Wapampong when he was cremated, we had a great discussion afterwards. What did Ajahn Chah teach? What was his main teachings? Was he ascetic? Was it the Vinaya? Was it his one-liners, his great wisdom, his deep meditation practice? What was it? And you found people arguing because everyone had their own Ajahn Chah. They learned what was important for them. And what they didn't understand, they just put aside. It was like a buffet. So many teachings. And so we were arguing for a while, and one of the seniors, who's Ajahn Jacobo, who I just spent a couple of days with hanging out with him, in Chicago, just before the conference. Very nice man. And as I said, you know, he's very happily married, but if you've been a monk for a few years, excellent husbands. Really kind. But anyway, he started up and said, everyone's got their own Ajahn Chah, as they always will. So we don't argue. It's just the old, in reality, the old story of the seven blind men feeling the elephant. We've all got our own experiences, so please never argue who owns the right Ajahn Chah. You've just heard of Ajahn Brahm's Ajahn Chah. In other words, you'll hear other people's Ajahn Chah. When I pass away, there'll be so many other Ajahn Brahms as well. It's what you remember. But what's most important is how innovative, how much fun and joy and deep insight came when he was unconventional but still keeping to the core Buddhist teachings. So do not be a clone of your teacher. Dhammasara is a monk's factory, Bodhidharma is a monk's factory, but already I'm concerned. The monks are coming up and they're telling all my old jokes. If you haven't heard them enough already. The same sort of style. No. Do it yourself. Take it further. Innovate. Don't let the truth stand in the way of your learning. Be kind. Innovative. And most importantly, good fun. Otherwise, people fall asleep. Okay, so that was just about an hour of little memories of Ajahn Chah. I had a great respect for his 99th birthday a couple of days ago, if he's still alive. So, now, any questions that you have? Personal experiences or comments about one of the great masters? Well, you want some more stories? some more stories of Ajahn Chah. Yes! Let me think one up. This happened when, it's a great little meditation story. This is talking more about his death and his meditation, how he taught. You know that sometimes you hear these little one-liners which are very inspiring. You may read some of Ajahn's teachings, which is so illuminating. But the real life, staying with a monk like that, he could talk for such a long time, and it was so boring. And I say that out of great respect. Because sometimes you can't always be inspiring people every minute, every sound bite. And he would often repeat himself a lot as well. But every now and again he would say something which was worth waiting for 2 or 3 hours for. A timeless wisdom which was not just waiting for 2 or 3 hours, waiting most of my life for teachings like that. Much to the point, powerful. I could read all the other stuff in the books. This was, wow, seeing it from its essence. And he was giving a talk one night, going on and on and on. Now those of you who have visited monasteries in Thailand, sometimes you find very young boys in the temple. Sometimes it's a social safety net for them. If their parents die, or if they have got no other place to go, you can always go to a temple, to a monastery. It's like an orphanage for boys. And they usually get well looked after, they can go to school, get a good moral education, about 17 or 18, and then they can go off, you know, go to university, get girlfriends and stuff. It's part of that wonderful tradition, a little social safety net. So, there was a young boy there who was in Ajahn Chah's monastery, and he was getting more and more bored by the talk. After an hour or 2 hours, he thought, I'm only maybe 10 or 11 year old. It's okay for these big guys, you know, they're adults, they're grown ups, they can endure, but I'm a kid, I should be, you know, up till 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock in the morning. And so he started to get very restless. So much restless that he started to complain, start thinking. And the thought kept going around and around and around his head, when is Ajahn Chah going to stop? When is he going to stop? Apparently they have at these days. So, are we there yet? Are we there yet? Are we there yet? Somebody tried that, your father's probably great. Are we going to get there soon? I don't care. We're months, we're patient. I never say, are we there yet? So, he was saying, when's he going to stop? When's he going to stop? When's he going to stop? This went round in his head for such a long time that he got this amazing insight to just seeing things in the opposite way. Just one thought, when am I going to stop? This little 10-year-old boy said to himself. Not when he going to stop, when am I going to stop? And that's when this little novice stopped. When he opened his eyes, it was dawn, he missed the afternoon in the morning. All the monks had left. And when monks leave, they do their bowing, they do some chanting, they make a lot of noise. He hadn't heard any of that at all. He'd been sitting there for such a long time, having a lot of happiness and bliss. He stopped with first deep meditation. So those are the great little teachings which I heard. If you're thinking a lot and saying, when is Ajahn Brahm going to stop? When is he going to stop? That's not the right question. When am I going to stop? You stop. Little 10-year-old novice could do that. He was about to do that. He understood what's happening. So the last thing, I was with Ajahn Chah from 1974 to 1983 when he sent me to Australia. And this is 100% true. I made a resolution, my way of letting go, not having control, having faith and confidence in my teacher. I made a vow. I would never ask to go anywhere or to come back to somewhere. I waited till Ajahn Chah would send me. So all my monastic life when I was there, I don't ask you to go over there to that monastery, and I would go, no question. I wait until he asks me to come back. I come back. I go to another monastery, and then afterwards, when he sent for me, I'd come back again. That was my life. I never chose where I was going to go. So, starting a new monastery in Perth, and he said, I don't know, off you go to Perth. About a month after I went to Australia, Ajahn Chah had a stroke, from which time on he could not speak again. He could not ask me to come back, so that is why I've been stuck in Australia for the past 33 years. That's true, because that's my vow, my determination, so I was there and I got stuck there. I'm not, no complaints, very nice place to stay in. But after he had his stroke, he could not speak, he could not communicate, he was like that about 9 years. But what he did when he was so-called not able to communicate, many monks told me this, had similar experiences. First of all, His Majesty the King of Thailand actually intervened. The monks had a meeting, why keep him alive? Just let nature take its course. So they had a big meeting and said, we will let him die. But when His Majesty the King of Thailand heard about that, he said, no, have to keep him alive. So His Majesty the King of Thailand paid for medics around the clock to look after him at 8-hour shifts. And for 9 years. And also, that a couple of monks would also be around as well. Sometimes a night shift, the day shift, the afternoon shift. And many times it would happen at night time. Ajahn Chah would stop breathing. Couldn't breathe at all. And this one particular case, he didn't breathe. And these were trained medics. Like nurses, male nurses, highly qualified, because this was looking after a great monk. Couldn't find any sign of any breath. And the monk said, well, leave him alone. This is just meditating, that's all. But that is not conventional medical wisdom. If you stop breathing for too long, it means you get brain damage, and then you die. You can't even control your internal organs. So I wanted to intervene. The monk said, no, have to. As I often joke, that the medics knew that Ajahn Chah would die one day, but this particular medic did not want Ajahn Chah to die on his ship. You can understand that if you work in hospitals. So, wanted to intervene? No. And I had this wonderful little experiment. It's a shame it wasn't done under laboratory conditions and actually put in some medical journal. So, he wasn't breathing at all. So it came to a compromise. The only purpose of breathing is to oxygenate your blood. So it's not breathing that's a problem, it's the fact that the blood gets depleted oxygen after a while. So this medic took blood samples every few minutes from one of Ajahn Chah's veins to test out the oxygen level of the blood. And beautiful experiment which was done. For several hours, there was no breath discernible, but the blood was always well oxygenated, and also being pumped around. How that could work without any oxygen, I don't know, but that's what happened. And as long as the blood was well oxygenated, there was no danger there. So the medic was quite happy just to let Ajahn Chah carry on without breathing. And for those people who know meditation, that is the fourth jhana and above. So that's even like little proof that Ajahn Chah, even though he was supposed to have a stroke, was meditating to the deepest of levels all that time. Ajahn Chah was not just a funny monk, he wasn't just a wise monk, he was an incredibly deep meditator. Was he enlightened? Was he an arhat? Fully enlightened? And my answer, always people say, oh, maybe he was, maybe he wasn't. Because all the time, you know, I never saw him get angry, I never saw him get upset after all those years. And that's not confirmation. People can fake that, they can play it. But you know, one of the experiences which really convinced me that this monk was the real deal was when he asked me to go up to his private quarters where he lived, which was usually out of bounds for him to go to. At last I could see if he had any Playboy magazines under his back, see if he had any contraband in there somewhere. And so I was so excited. But when I went into his private room, I can still visualize it today. It was just almost tears come to your eyes. All that was there was a little grass mat, a wooden pillow, and there was one robe on the line. And that was it. Nothing more. And at this time, Ajahn Chah was being visited by Her Majesty the Queen of Thailand, invited down to Bangkok. Big generals, incredibly rich people would give him anything. What did he have in his room? Absolutely nothing. Now that really impressed me, to see how a great monk really is. They can speak huge amounts of inspiring teachings. They have so much knowledge about what the Buddha said. They could even do those little tricks which I've done many times, reading people's minds. An amazing wisdom. But to see how many attachments he had, how many possessions. Nothing at all. That was a sign of a great monk. It's so inspiring to see that that can still be done. So anyway, then I'm just reminiscing about the great Ajahn Chah monk. Yeah.
How did Ajahn Chah, or why did Ajahn Chah accept you?
Why he accepted me? Why not? Just because you're an unknown. That was also just an amazing thing to see. All types of people were accepted. No discrimination. No, whether you are from Thailand, southern Thailand, where you're highly educated or poorly educated, whether you know you were had some disability or no disabilities. It was totally non-discriminating. Everyone was given a chance. Some never made it, many did. So for Westerners, you know, he never gave us any special privileges. People asked at the time, but these are Westerners, they're not used to sticky rice and frogs and bugs. Can we get them special Western food? And that's what I said, no. No. So we had to eat what everyone else ate, which was disgusting. Really bad food. You know, the old frog on rice. That's 1 meal a day, that's all we had, a bowl of sticky rice, the glutinous rice, and a boiled frog on top. That was all. Nothing else. And the frog, you know, no chili sauce, no soy sauce, no garlic, nothing, no salt, pepper, just boiled frog on top of rice, 3-1 meal a day. Because that's all the villagers had. And they gave us the best frogs. Out of respect for rice. But even that, I remember I was a vegetarian before, so you had to eat frog on rice. And I still remember this story. And I teach this when I go to schools. Number one, children love gross stories. They remember those. And number two, to try and motivate them to pay attention, especially in science class. Because I had to study biology, so they learned about a frog. I paid attention at the time when the teacher was telling me about what organ was which. But the monk sitting next to me obviously did not pay attention at all. He didn't know what part of the frog was which. So, where the meat on the legs, first of all, is like chicken. And that's why the French eat frog's legs, but they don't eat the other part of the frog. I had to. So he's picking out his organs to get something to last the day. This monk pressed the frog's bladder, which still had urine in it, and the frog peed all over his ass. Just because it's dead doesn't mean it hasn't got urine inside. Pressed it all over his ass. No matter how hungry you are, you can't eat that. But that's not the gross thing. But I don't shy. I said, no, just, you know, let them sort of eat that stuff. He could have just, you know, said one thing and get nice food. No. It's amazing just what you can eat. I think one of the reasons was because, you know, he knew that one day I'll be a teacher, so he knew I had to get some nice stories to get people to the stage. Yeah. And even though it was tough, people like snakes, always be kind to the snakes will never bite you. They never harm you at all. And all those years I was there, never once was a person bitten by a snake. And they were crawling all over you. I remember I was doing some chanting once, and I thought, I had to stop because on the back of a fetch monk, a snake was crawling up his back, and I saw it, just made as far as you are for this. The snake's head came up, from the back, and the monks were looking at me, and the monk turned around, and the snake turned around, and the two were eyeballing one another, and they just, the crazy thing, the snake here, both didn't know what to do, so you know, the snake was just exploring, so this monk is very calm, just pushed his robe off very gently, so the snake could fall off and just go away. So, just being kind, the snakes will never harm you, and you don't harm them. So it's wonderful, seeing all these amazing things. One of the animals I really used to love were the tarantulas. Because the tarantulas, they would crawl on the rafters on the roof, which is an open roof. And in that hot weather, that was made in England. So sometimes we meditated just in a bare chested, just having my lower robe on. Sometimes you lay down in the hot weather, and sometimes the tarantulas would fall from the roof, right on your tummy, bare. They really ticklish, it was actually quite stimulating. Yeah, they keep falling. They're not going to bite you. They're just going their way, and they're quite welcome to crawl on my tummy. Off away somewhere else. But actually there was an afterlife left. Then actually, and the first time I heard that a snake actually bit a monk. I tell that story because it was a Singaporean monk. I was in Australia at the time this happened, so I only got the anecdote. So one of the Western monks, the Ang Mo monks, was in the library, and just this Singapore monk just came into the library and said, "Where is the snake book?" So that's over here, got the snake book. And the Singapore monk was like, "Oh my goodness, that's the one which has just bitten, and it's deadly." And the monk, "What? You mean by that? Yes, help!" No mobile phones in those days. In fact, trying to get an ambulance would be impossible, so they didn't need an ambulance. They had one of these, like witch doctors, spirit people in the village. So this monk, this is the time of monk, he's allowed to run, ran into the village and came back with a vehicle with a spirit doctor. And the spirit doctor looked at the wound. I mean, this was, you see the puncture marks, and the leg was swelling, and the venom was spreading, and started doing this chanting, and just also spitting on the wound. So which the Singaporean monk, who was highly educated, turned around to the other monks and said, "Can I please have a proper doctor?" Imagine that was you. You know, we do believe in all this this weird stuff, the witchery. But as he was washing, it was a waste of time trying to get a proper doctor, because you know, it would take hours to get there. And so just while everyone was washing, doing the simple chanting and spitting on the wood, the swelling went down and the two puncture wounds was closed. It disappeared, it went. And perfectly healthy afterwards. Doesn't make any sense, according to medical science, but people saw that and it worked. That was the life and death method. Life and death time. So there's so many things you saw. There's this old wisdom, wizardry if you like, but you saw it. As a theoretical physicist, my training was to be skeptical, but if you saw something with your own eyes, well, something's happening there. Unfortunately, that's knowledge which has been lost now. Not many people remember that stuff because they don't believe in it. But it worked. So that's why we weren't too afraid of spiders and other stuff. It always gets chanting. It's much, much cheaper than taking medication. I don't know how much your healthcare bill is here in Singapore, but there we go.
So Ajahn, what happened to the Singaporean monk after that?
I'm not sure where he went to, but he was fine afterwards. No trouble. No side effects. If you actually have the medication or you have the anti-venom, that's really heavy stuff. They do have side effects there. But this stuff was fine. There's a real wound, you can see it there. The swelling, anything. Very dangerous. Dangerous snake, but no trouble. Yeah.
Well, I don't know whether you've been following what has happened in Singapore, but two siblings have sued the Prime Minister. I wonder what Ajahn Chah would have done if he had done the whole and boy from the
Oh, which one? The two siblings from the Prime Minister.
And get some water. What would he have done?
Ajahn.
The three of them.
No, he did go and visit one of the other famous monks in the time of Ajahn Charles, Ajahn Khao. And he told this story afterwards. They talked to one another, just old friends, very high attained monks. And he said, how's life teaching you, treating you now, said Ajahn Khao to Ajahn Chah. Ajahn Chah said, I live like a monkey. What do you mean? He said, I'm like in a cage and people keep poking me with their sticks. He said, no, that's like being a famous teacher. I can appreciate that now. I can't even just go to the toilet without people following me. And you keep poking me, asking questions of meditation and asking. So when you become a well-known teacher, that's what it feels like. They always want to feed you stuff. I can really appreciate why monkeys sometimes get so upset that people staring at them, they take out their feces and throw them at them. But you know, they haven't got the training which monks have, so I will never do that, you're perfectly safe. But sometimes it feels like being in a zoo. People come to have a look at you and poke you just to see you perform. So that's why sometimes you have to have these signs in the zoo, please don't feed the monkeys. I thought maybe putting that up in the monastery, but anyway, he also said that Ajahn Khao was saying there's two people in the monastery having a big argument. So what should I do? I can't settle who's right and who's wrong. And Ajahn Chah said, send both of them away. They're both wrong. And that's when he said that one person, when you're having an argument, like the Prime Minister and those two siblings, say one side, he said, you're right, but not correct. The two siblings are right, but not correct. The Prime Minister is correct, but not right. There's a wonderful way of understanding that both people are wrong. When we have an argument. It's not that, you know, the other party is at fault in your mind. One party is right, the other one is correct. You're right but not correct, you're correct but not right. It's a wonderful way. Imagine there was a big argument in a football match and the referee took the ball catch and said, "You're correct, you're not right, you're right but not correct." Yeah. Oh, this is a talk which I did, Be Kind, Not Be Wise, yes. If you're going to create drama with another person, people love drama. A life without drama for most people is just so boring, they have to follow Korean dramas. I realize that people are addicted to dramas. And if life is too peaceful and harmonious, you create drama. So I wonder, why people have created so many problems in this world? You know, there's plenty of food for everybody, there's, you know, nice good health care, Singapore is just a beautiful country. What drama do you have? You get too bored, so we want to create some drama. So be kind and give her some drama. Well, it's an important point, then, to feel that people are afraid of peace. And then this peace is nothing to do. And people are addicted to doing stuff. I just can't understand why it is when people go on holiday, why you don't stay at home. You've got these beautiful homes, paid a lot of money for, and there is no place like home. There's no, all the really kind, trying to get a nice mattress for me, a nice bed, and aircon in the room. Your mum has spent so much time trying to get just right for me, but there's no place like your own bed and your own pillow. You just can't replicate that. So tomorrow, when I go back to Bodhidharma Monastery, go in my cave, there's my bed, my pillow, and I'll have the best sleep for days, for weeks. Even if I stay in a 5-star hotel, 6-star hotel, you can't repeat that. So there's no place like your own bed. There's no food like homemade food, your own food. But this is your place. You feel so comfortable there. So I don't understand why it is the first time you have a chance to have a holiday, you have to go overseas, pack your bags, wait in a queue to check in, be frisked by security because, you know, they're always afraid of bombs. And then have to wait in your aircraft, and sometimes in the aircraft you have to wait, queue up to go to the toilet. I don't know how long some people spend in the toilet, and by the time your turn comes, you're about to land, you've got to go sit down again. You know, you have those experiences like I have as well. So, what do you do that for? Can't you stay at home and enjoy yourself? Why do you want to go places? And people say, "Oh, I want to go shopping." Why do you want to go anywhere to go shopping? People in Singapore, they tell me they go to Perth to do shopping. People in Australia come to Singapore to do shopping. And it's the disconnect though, I can't get my head around it. Maybe because I'm a man, I don't understand it. But it's literally, you always think to go shopping. Every place you want to go, you get it here, you don't need to go to Orchard Road anymore. Or to Perth. Amazon. eBay. Just go online, you check whatever you want, get the best prices, and it's delivered to you. You don't have to go even into the shop, you don't have to wait in queues anymore. Is that going to be the end of Orchard Road? No way. Because you want to go into it, so you want to feel it. Have you ever found that out, that as you like going shopping, your husband said, can I do something else? That's why, I remember this shopping centre, a shopping mall over in the United States, brilliant idea. Because, you know, the husband has to go with you. So they have like a little place just for husbands. They're either watching the football or something on there. And they have fast food, which they really like, which you don't allow them to eat. You put them in there, you know, for a couple of hours where you do the shopping and you pick them up on the way home. The shopping malls really get very popular that way. But anyway, the point was that why do I believe? Kind of stay home. Why? Because people like drama, they like a bit of discomfort. In Toronto, Angie and Eileen, they have to go and see Niagara Falls. They invited me along as well. What am I going to see Niagara Falls? What do you want to see Niagara Falls for? Just go in the shower. That's water. What a difference. It's all hype. And then they go, have you been to the Great Wall of China? You have plenty of walls in Singapore. To me, I just can't get my head around it, so I don't go to Niagara Falls. Actually, I did go to Niagara Falls once when I was 1969. That was one of my to-do lists when I went to the United States. You know, 1969, you can check it out on the internet, they turned the water off. Niagara Falls was dry at that time, because they had to do repairs. It's true. So can I say Niagara Falls, I'm sorry, it's not falling today. The weird, but true, check it out, 1969, they did urgent repairs on the rock face. But anyway, I don't know if the answer to your question was just fun. So why do you want to go places? There was an adept fella, one of the other reasons, not just because he could read minds. You looked and checked him out, and honestly, the happiest person I've ever seen. And there was a man with no education, no wife, but don't you guys say, oh, that's the reason we're so happy. No. Why do women live longer than men? Because men are smarter than men. I'm not going there. Well, monks live longer than all of you. Married men, married women, monks. Peace, freedom, no stress. But anyway, what was I talking about there? Just learning just that Ajahn Chah was such a happy monk. Even people would stir him up. And that was so important. I wanted to see a finished product. And someone, where's this place going to lead to? Becoming enlightened? Do you really want to become enlightened? Is it worth it? If you find out being enlightened being so miserable, so terrible existence, I want to see that person was happy when they were wise. I never want to see a wisdom which upset people. A wisdom which was happy. Which is one of the reasons why I came back to your question that kindness is more important than wisdom. By wisdom I meant like learning and what you're told. Kindness and care. The reason I said that was that if you didn't hear this talk, is a response to the question of terrorism in this world. Now, how could somebody leave a bomb in that venue in Manchester, knowing that there'd be young children beginning of their lives would be killed? How could anyone actually do that? There's been more terrorist attacks since. It's very much because we believe in an ideology, a dogma, a faith. I think it was Mark Allen. I think he was one of the founders of Apple. Was Steve Jobs? I think he's one of those guys. And he's quoted, and it's a powerful quote, that usually bad people do bad things, but it's only religion makes good people do bad things. And there's a lot of truth to that. So why is that the case? Because too many religions tell you what to believe, rather than letting you be aware of how you feel. And then, now you're shouting at your husband, you've got so many reasons to do that, when you feel it, it doesn't feel right, it just can't be there. Blowing up children. If you think about it, you can do it. You justify it with dogmas. When you feel it, you just can't do it. There's a little kid there in front of you. Don't matter what religion they are, what faith, what race, it's just when you feel them, there's no way you could do it. It's one of the reasons why real compassion is always much more powerful than wisdom. By wisdom, I mean what you've been taught, what you've been told. So sometimes dogma, even books, people beat each other over the head with the books. Some of those books are so thick, they really hurt. But my book is more accurate than your book. So we fight over the books, hit each other over the head with them. But I understand what the books are there for is the opening your heart. So understanding how it feels and trusting that much more than anything else. So that's, you know, a Buddhist answer to the problem of terrorism and extremism. It's not just extreme Islam, extreme Christianity, extreme Buddhism as well. Extreme right-wing ideology, extreme left-wing communist ideology. Those extreme things which you use that dogma to overcome what you feel. Even extreme medical science as well. Instead of feeling it, this is what you're supposed to do. A good doctor knows. Follow your heart and intuition. As long as the lawyers are not around. Okay. Oh, it's actually kind of time. Yeah, you guys have got jobs to go to tomorrow, and the economy of Singapore is important. If you all lose your jobs and get poor, there's nobody to pay the bills for the Buddhist Congress and the Buddhist Fellowship and the Buddhist whatever. So, thank you. People ask me, the Buddhist monk, do you agree with just, you know, that people making money and becoming rich? I say, yeah. Otherwise, our temple would be in big trouble. Thank you for the questions. Thank you.